Okay, welcome everyone. First of all, let me begin. Today is Yud Ches Iyar, 18th of Iyar, which is actually the yahrzeit of the Maharal, anniversary of the passing of the Maharal. So just let me start with one idea from the Maharal regarding tshuva, which is actually a bit of an optimistic idea. It's a good thing to hear. It says in the Yud Gimel Midas Rachmim, the 13 attributes of divine mercy. So it says, V'nakeh lo yenakeh. So that's actually a type of like chops off the end of the pasuk for the Balei Korah amongst us, right? And for those who actually learn Tanakh, right? So v'nakeh means, and he shall cleanse. Lo yenakeh means he shall not cleanse. So actually it's he'll cleanse those who apparently, do tshuva. And then lo yenakeh, so the Gemara actually says, what does it mean, nakeh lo yenakeh? So the Gemara says in Yuma, yenakeh l'shavim, he will cleanse those who return. The lawyer not care, but he will not cleanse those who don't return. So the Maharal asks, so how exactly is that an attribute of mercy? Right? Oh, you know, if you do tshuva, you're forgiven. And if you don't, you're not forgiven. Wow, that's amazing. Right? So even if you say that tshuva is a chesed, a kindness of Hashem, which is an excellent question and a matter of debate, but let's say it is, but then how is lawyer not care that he will not cleanse an attribute of mercy? It's a little strange. So the Maharal's answer is the following. What it really means is this, that it's talking about the one person, the same person. Meaning, if a person does tshuva for one thing, but not for everything, it's not like Hashem says, sorry, you haven't had a complete transformation, no forgiveness. No. The attribute of mercy is that, yeah, he won't cleanse that which he didn't do tshuva for, but he will cleanse that which he did for tshuva for. So even though in the one person, we may not have done tshuva for absolutely everything, because as one of my kids commented when he went through after Al-Chait on Yom Kippur, he says, you know, they missed a whole bunch. Right? So, you know, when you go through Al-Chait and you say, I missed a whole bunch of things, right? You have to ask yourself, like, either there's something wrong with me or with Chazal, right? So, but obviously, if you didn't do tshuva for everything, that doesn't mean that it's hopeless. Maharal says is, you tshuva for some things, so you're forgiven for those things. Hashem doesn't say, no, I need absolutely everything right now. So it's nakeh lo yenakeh. For the same person, there could be nakeh, there could be cleansing, and there could be non-cleansing. But it doesn't mean the fact that there's no cleansing for the stuff you didn't do tshuva for does not mean that the stuff you did do tshuva for is not forgiven. So that's an optimistic message from the Maharal. So the title is Lessons from Balei Tshuva, or Great Balei Tshuva, etc. It's interesting, you look through history. So if you'd ask people, name a Baal Tshuva from hundreds of years ago, it'd be very hard to find them. You know, you have the Gemara mentions Eliezer ben Durdaya, Gemara in Avodah Zorah, very famous. But there's not that many. You know, you have a tshuva of Rashi. I don't mean tshuva, I mean responsum of Rashi. Yeah, right. So in which there's a couple who actually were Christians and came back to Yiddishkeit. So they were Balei Tshuva. You know, you have Jews who after the 1391 riots in Spain, so a lot of Jews became Christians, and some of them kept Judaism secretly, the crypto-Jews, etc. And there were Jews who maintained their Yiddishkeit to some level. We don't know exactly how much. You know, there were certain people who only kept Tanis Esther, because they understood Esther was the first crypto-Jew. So they looked at it. She was a hero. She was the first crypto-Jew. But some of these people came out of the Iberian Peninsula in the 16th century, 17th century. They came to Hamburg, Amsterdam, etc., and they attached themselves to the Jewish community. You've got to understand, that's unbelievable. That means they kept some spark of Judaism alive in circumstances where they had no Jewish education. And by the way, one of the great dilemmas was, when do you tell your kids that you're secretly Jewish? If you tell them too young, they're going to blurt it out at the playground, and boom, Inquisition. Nobody expects this. So, and then you tell them when they're too old, they're going to turn you into the Inquisition because they're already committed Christians. So when do you even tell your kids? And how do you tell them? And what do you educate them? And how do you educate them? There's no books. But some of these people, nevertheless, after living pretty much as Christians for over 100 years, families for maybe a couple of generations, they come out to areas of Europe where you could practice Judaism, and they attach themselves to the Jewish community. That's their Balei Tshuva in an amazing way. There was even a genre of literature of people producing works on basic Judaism in Spanish. for the benefit of people who come from Spain to other parts of Europe, like an early version of Art Scroll, to help them. They didn't know any Hebrew, right? And this is giving them gifts. So that's an amazing thing. You have very few. There's a Keser Torah in the Abu Havshul in Tzfat, which is dedicated to the Balei Tshuva. It's not referring to contemporary. That's referring to Balei Tshuva from the 15th, 16th century, people who returned to Judaism after having been coerced or pressured or whatever it was, converted to Judaism. So there are few and far between. So it's really an amazing schus that we live in a world where there are, if I'd ask people, do you know any people who have returned to Judaism? So probably most people put up their hand, I'm guessing. Right? Most people have met a Balei Tshuva, etc. Some of you who may have met a Balei Tshuva have no idea that they are Balei Tshuva, right? So their pronunciation is correct and their dress, right? The whole works, right? So you would have no idea. But we have a tremendous schus. Remember, there was a guy, an elderly Russian Jew, Frum guy in Arzea Bira. So I used to teach at Or Sameach. He used to come and daven at Or Sameach. So I don't know, I was schmoozing with him one day and I said, so you like the davening here? He says, not really, it's a little long, right? I said, yeah, I feel the same. I said, so why do you daven here? He says, because when I grew up, I never ever saw anyone who came back to Yiddishkeit. I only saw people leaving. Socialist, communist, that's it. I never saw anyone. In my entire life, he was a man who was in his 70s. He says, I come here and there is a base medrash of about 200 guys and they're all people who went in the opposite direction. They came back to Yiddishkeit. He says, as long as the davening is, this is inspiring. This is unbelievable. Here's a guy who was Moshe Nefesh for Yiddishkeit in Russia. Unbelievable. And he was inspired by the fact that these people had returned to Yiddishkeit. That's one lesson, very basic lesson. Is that there are people who go against the historical current, and there are people who have which was usually arrow out, and they turned it around the other way. There are some people, maybe you have heard of them, maybe you have not. But the first one I mentioned was Eliezer ben Durdaya. So the Gemara has a long story about him. It's one of Avodah Zorah Yud Zayin, and it says that he had literally visited every prostitute in the Middle East. I don't know. It says in the world, but, I assume it means Babylon or, Middle East. That's someone who is pretty serious level of Averis, you know what I mean? He'd have to learn martial arts to do a proper al-khayt. I mean, just like a ninja heart blow type of thing, you know. Okay. Right, so... Anyway, he is the Gemara says that he decided. There was this whole story. I won't go into it, but he is inspired to do tshuva, and he sits amongst the mountains, and he says, Harim bikshu ala rachmim, ask mercy for me, and the mountains say, what are you kidding? We're going to be squashed in the future. There's no way. Tosfos already says the mountains are not talking. Either it's happening in his mind, or it's the saror shel har, the angels, the spiritual energy of them, which is communicating. Right, mountains don't talk. And then he asks the shamayim, the heavens, to beg mercy. And in the end, he says the following very interesting statement: Ein hadavar talui ela bi. The matter is only dependent upon me. And at that point, since he put his head between his knees, he into a position of abject tears, and he cried, and he died. And a voice from heaven, Baskol, came out and said that Rebbe, it called him Rebbe Eliezer ben Durdaya Mezuman Lachaya Olam Haba. Rebbe Eliezer ben Durdaya is going to attain life in the world to come. And Rebbe says, not enough for Balei Tshuva that their tshuva is accepted, but they're even given the title Rebbe. So interesting. What does it mean? He says, "Ena dava talu elabi." So one, I guess, one important lesson here is the following. The simple explanation is that you can "Ena nili mili." If I'm not for myself, who is for me? No one can actually make you do tshuva. No one can actually, do it for you. Even if someone davens for you, that's the famous case of Bruria and Reb Meir, where Reb Meir is being accosted by thugs, skinheads in the neighborhood, Brioine. Right, some soccer firm, and they're accosting him, and he says to Bruria, he says, "I'm going to daven that they die." And she says, look, it says, Yitamach HaTomer Shem Odeinam, the evil shall be no more, so obviously, Shadavan they die. She says, well, you're reading the Pasuk incorrectly. The Pasuk actually says that sin will be eliminated, therefore there'll be no more evil. There won't be no more evil because the evil people are eliminated. There won't be evil people because Avera, Chatoim, sins are eliminated. She says, rather than Davan, that they die, Davan, they do tshuva. So the Marsha asks, well, how could you daven that someone does tshuva? Hakol b'dash shemayim chutz miyoshua. Everything's in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Tshuva is in your hands. It's bechira, it's free will. You can't daven that intervene in someone's bechira. So it's a question dealt with. Marsha doesn't really give an answer. The Igros Moshe says you can daven that they find themselves in circumstances conducive to tshuva. You can hope that they hear a good shiur, they end up in a good environment, they have a nice Shabbos meal with excellent cholent. Whatever it is, the things that induce people to do tshuva, you can pray for. But in the end, the decision, the thing is only dependent upon me, that is ultimately in the hands of the human being. No one else can ever make you do tshuva. Rav Kook understands this a little differently when he says, "Im ain anili mili." He says the following, you know, the first Aveira ever, Adam and Chava, what is Hashem's question to them after they do it? He says, Ayeka, which means, where are you? So Rav Kook says that the question was not, and I think all the Mepharshim say, it was obviously not a geographical question. You know, where are those people? I could have sworn I had some people here. Right, no, that's not right, it's Ayeka means, where is your you? You abandoned your true identity and gave yourself over to someone else, i.e., you listen to the Nachash, the Yetzer Hara, whatever, but something from outside of yourself. You didn't listen to yourself. So Ayeka, where is you? That's how he's asking. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is asking Adam and Chava, where is the you, the real you? The real you should be with me. You shouldn't have given yourself over to the influence of something outside of yourself, something foreign to yourself, the Nachash, the Yetzer Hara, who are Yetzer Hara, Malach HaMavis, etc., who are Sotan, all the same thing the Gemara says in Bava Basra. That's really what it means. Eina dava talui eila bi, tshuva is dependent upon finding me, meaning returning to my true essence and to my true self. When Yechezkel says, Va'ani betocha gola, I was in the midst of the exile. Again, Rav Kook says, that's not a geographical statement. That is saying that the Ani, the true I, is found in the midst of exile. And so really, what Rabbi Elazar ben Dudaya is telling us is, Ein adava talui elabi, the matter depends on finding my true self and not looking at things outside of me, things outside of my true essence, and really trying to discover who my true essence, getting back to that. So that's number one, and that is something which you find with Balei Tshuva throughout history when they describe that process. It's really a process of Ein Adava Talui Elabi. It's actually finding my real self. This is where I belong. Two examples, which, you know, I don't know if people have heard of them. You probably have heard of them. But one you've almost certainly heard of. Two prominent. When I say prominent, they were prominent Balei Tshuva because they were pretty much the only people at their time who actually did it. There was almost no one else did Tshuva. Jiri Langer. Anyone heard of Jiri Langer? No. Okay. Jiri Langer was a Jew from Prague in the 1920s, 1930. Jiri Langer grew up in an assimilated family in Prague, middle-class Jewish family. You know, they used to do some type of traditional Friday night meal. They used to go to shul occasionally, not very often. They did not keep Shabbos or keep kosher. They had some nationalistic tendencies. They actually sent him to a tutor to teach him Hebrew. There were some Zionist tendencies there. So Jiri Langer grows up in this family in Prague. At the age of 19... he decides, after learning Hebrew, he got fascinated by Hebrew, and Hebrew led him to look into other Jewish texts written in Hebrew. And he was inspired, and he actually came across a Hasidic text, which he thought was cool. And I don't know if anything cool existed in Prague in 1930, but whatever the equivalent was, right? Dope, sick, etc. So he decided to go to Bell's, not School of Music, but he decided to go to Bell's in Poland. Age 19, packed up his bags from Prague, and he went to Bell's, and he became Hasidish. He became a Bell's of Hasid. Later on, he became a religious Zionist, moved to Israel, but he initially, at age 19, it was unbelievable. So his brother, Frantisek Langer, he writes, he says, after 24 hours of travel in a dirty train, Jiri found himself 500 kilometres away to the east and simultaneously 2 or 5 centuries back in time. A lad from the beautiful city of Prague, a lad from a Jewish family accustomed to a 20th century environment, with all the advantages of modern town life, had taken up his abode amongst fellow believers living as a little nation entirely on their own, beyond some inner frontier, all the more inaccessible to time and space. They had their own religion, their own language, their own traditions, history, education, backward ideas, cherished superstitions, rejected... unbelievable. So this is how his brother described... And Jiri came back from Bell's, dressed as a Bell's a Chosid, to Prague. The family were embarrassed out of their minds. He says they'd seen Hasidim at the spa resorts in Czechoslovakia. But these were Hasidim who were wealthy. They had beautiful beards. They had wonderful silk kaftans. They looked very dignified. The women were dressed beautifully. The men were dressed very beautifully. He says, but not like his brother, who's emaciated with a tattered bekesher and his payas like wild and stuff like that, embarrassed. And Jiri is in Prague for a while, and he goes back to Bell's. So that's unbelievable. To learn from Jiri, I'm not sure if I'm even pronouncing it. He wrote a book about this. It's called Nine Gates to the Hasidic Mysteries. Nine gates about Hasidism, with stories about Hasidic rebbes. But a few things that stood out to me, which we can learn from him. Well, first of all, number one is to have that courage to actually do what you feel is correct, despite everything, which of course is how the Shulchan Aruch starts, right? Al yizbayesh bifnei al maligin. Do not be embarrassed in the presence of those who make fun of you. So that is one of the primary characteristics Jew has to have. That's Shulchan Aruch starts with that, right? Az kenamer, be as audacious as a leopard, right? Apparently, leopards, at least according to my friend Slifkin, tells me that leopards are very audacious. They'll attack animals 10 times their size. They have no fear whatsoever, right? So it's audaciousness, chutzpah. But it's chutzpah on the correct side, on the side of Kedusha, in which I don't care that the entire world could be saying that I'm an idiot or I'm a nerd or whatever it is. It's what happened with Jiri Langer, and he pursued his path, which he believed in. We find this in people who are not Balei Tshuva, the Ramchal. Imagine the Ramchal, the courage of the Ramchal. He had the Beis Din of Venice, the Beis Din of Hamburg, various Gedolei Hador putting him in Cherem, forbidding him from teaching Kabbalah, saying that he is a Sabbatean, and so on and so forth, and he kept going. There's no way that a person... How could a person do that? That's unbelievable courage for him to keep going through all of that. Right. And he moves to Amsterdam, right, leaving beloved Italy, and he is banned from teaching Kabbalah. So he writes Mesil Shasharim and Derech Hashem. So obviously that's not called giving up. You know what I mean? You write Mesil Shasharim Derech Hashem, right? That's unbelievable. So Jiri Langer had that. And so number one we can learn from that, very basic lesson, Al Yizbayesh Bifnei Amaligim Alav. Do not be embarrassed. Do what you believe is right. That's unbelievable courage, and that's required of every Jew. That's why Shulchan Aruch starts with that. All right, not to be embarrassed. This is who you are. Number two, a sense of, I guess, amazement and appreciation for what we have, which is not... See, when you're a Baal Teshuva, you're coming from outside. So a Baal Teshuva may... Like, I've had guys say to me, it's like, this Shabbos is like, what a great idea. God, it's a great idea. I mean, you have this like 24 hours, you're like, you're at no phone, right? Just like to be able to communicate to people actually normally without, right, as opposed to with your thumbs I mean, you can still use your thumb if you're learning. But I'm saying in terms of communication, right? So which is what thumb was used for texting, by the way. Just for those who are wondering, what's this vestigial organ? What did people do with this before there were phones? Right? What like people were walking around and said, what the heck is this for, man? There was a space bar, maybe, but even before then, what was it for? Right? But the appreciation of the Torah that we have, Kodesh Baruch Hu, so we sometimes take it for granted. So you have a person like Jiri Langer, it doesn't take it for granted. He says, he describes in his book, he says he walked into Bell's and he felt that Shabbos was like, this is a miracle. We've entered into this space and time which is beyond this world. I mean, I won't read you the whole description, but it's, the crowd of the devout swirls and streams, hums and seethes like molten lava. Suddenly, as though at a word of command, all remain with their faces towards the west, towards the entrance of the synagogue, bowing their heads in expectation. It is at this moment that the invisible queen of the Sabbath comes in and brings to each of us priceless heavenly gift, a second new festive soul. So, you know, when you're davening and Friday night and you turn around, right, and we're trying to figure out, what does it mean to go to the right? Oh, that's right. Oh, there you go, that way. Right? Instead, he's like saying, this is unbelievable. We are greeting we're having the Neshama Yesera. He's actually feeling it because it's so new to him. And that is something which we have to do, is appreciation. Obviously, appreciation, as Tal Ben Shachar often points out, is the basis. One of the most effective tools for happiness is to appreciate what you have. But appreciation is not just appreciation of the physical gifts that Hashem has given us, that we have clean drinking water, right, and that we have indoor plumbing, that we have a shelter and food, etc. But the gifts of the Torah is something which we have to appreciate continuously. When you encounter a Shabbos, to have that level of amazement of a Baal Tshuva, I think, is important, and I think it should not be lost. And I think something which a lot of Baal Tshuva have, that people who have grown up with it, people who've kept Shabbos for many years, sometimes we tend to lose that. The greatness of the Torah, the greatness of Shabbos, the greatness of Yiddishkeit is something which is I think we have to appreciate. There's another Baal Tshuva, which you probably have heard of him, Franz Rosenzweig. So he has an interesting story. Franz Rosenzweig was a German philosopher, completely secular, a brilliant philosopher, university lecturer, and he had come to the conclusion that he was going to convert to Christianity as a proud Jew. He would enter Christianity as a Jew. And he says in preparation for his conversion, he decided to go to Shul, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, and then after that experience, the Jewish experience, he'd enter Christianity as a Jew. Bizarre. So Rosh Hashanah didn't do much for him. But Yom Kippur, he went to an Orthodox shul. And the davening spoke to him. Ein adava talu ela bi. Like, he felt the davening actually speaking to his inner self. He listened to the words. He listened to the tunes. The rabbi, who was Rabbi Dr. Noble, gave a drosha which he said was amazing. He describes that. I'm not going to give you the description, but it must have been some drosha. And at that point, right after Yom Kippur, he decides, he was Jewish, but I'm going to be Shomer Torah Mitzvahs. Amazing thing. So we were discussing this at our table on Shabbos. One of my kids mentioned this type of interesting. He said, here he is, this complete intellectual who had made apparently a philosophical decision to embrace Christianity, but embrace it, not discarding his Jewish nationality and etc. And now, on the basis of an experience, he has abandoned all of that philosophy and decided to accept Yiddishkeit. So my son said, that's like a little weird, like for a philosopher. And you know, we discussed this until the Cholent came out. But I think we type of came to the conclusion that humans, I mean, and this is, I think, true, you know, humans are not machines. Right? If you'd be a machine, you'd be a computer, right? Logic. But sometimes experiential effects of something like tefillah, etc., is extremely important, should not be discarded. That means, because there, and even philosophy will tell me, that maybe the tefillah was speaking to a deeper layer of himself than than Christian philosophy, than theology, etc. Maybe it was speaking to a deeper layer of the self, which was his true self, which led him to embrace Yiddishkeit. And you know, he too was someone who, you know, when he did embrace Yiddishkeit, he embraced it and he started to, he opened something called a Lehrhaus, which was a house of learning. Towards the end of his life, he had a neurological sickness. He was paralyzed for a long time, over 5 years, I think it was. During that time, he says, I'm not choosing to focus on my paralysis. I'm choosing to continue. He continued teaching. He wrote a book during that time, which he dictated. They had made a special typewriter for him, which he was able to press just one key in different directions and get it. Eventually, his wife had to try to listen to what he was saying and type it out. But it's a lesson that he says he has never felt happier. And this is something which we were talking about in class yesterday in JSS, that comfort is not necessarily the same as happiness. And sometimes the greatest happiness comes from struggle and comes from growth. It's another idea from Seligman and Ben Shachar in positive psychology, that when you're stagnant, you're not happy. When you're not making progress, you're not happy. When you make progress, even if that progress is painful, that can bring you happiness. And if you know you're going in the right direction, as painful as it may be, and as the struggle may be, but you will ultimately, that will really make you happy. I remember asking one of my sons when he was in basic training, the first one I had this conversation, he was telling me what they were doing, sort of a combat training, and I asked him stupidly, so you're enjoying yourself. Now, I know anyone done basic training, right, that's not a question you would ask, right? Enjoying yourself, right? He said, no, I'm not enjoying myself, but I'm happy, which is very true. You don't have to be enjoying yourself to be happy. He was not enjoying it, right? But he was happy because he felt he was doing the right thing, making progress in the direction he wanted to. And that is a lesson. Franz Rosenzweig struggled with his sickness, with his paralysis, and struggled also with his own doubts and questions and everything else, but it brought him to a level where he said was the greatest happiness he'd achieved. One more Baal Tshuva, and we only have 3 minutes, so one more Baal Tshuva who I met in Israel, you may have heard of him, Effi Eitam. So Effi Eitam was a minister of infrastructure in Ariel Sharon's government. I don't think he's in the Knesset now. Effi Eitam was brought up on a very secular kibbutz, he was in elite unit of the Israeli army. I forgot which one. It was one of the Sayeret units, and he had done some stuff behind enemy lines, and he lost a number of comrades in the first Lebanon war, and it led him to wonder why he is here. He'd go to America, and he wouldn't have to fight. A little comfortable life. Why am I here? So he decided to pick up the Tanakh. You know, they give you a Tanakh in basic training. When you finish basic training, they have this ceremony. At the end, you get a Tanakh, right? So a gun and a Tanakh. I mean, the gun's already yours, but whatever, the ceremony. So, and he said, I decided to read the Tanakh. And I read the Tanakh, and I realized the Jewish people have this destiny. It was like a historical pattern. We've moved back to Israel. There's like we've moved around the world. We've come back. There's like a destiny. He says, and I'm part of that destiny. I'm playing an important part of that. And he enrolled in Machon Meir, and he became from. He got smicha, etc., etc. And the idea, and this is an important part for something for us to realize, that every single Jew is a part of that destiny of the Jewish people, and the impact of one person's actions are incalculable. And one person can, you could have 10 people, you could have one person, but it's not the type of thing that we can often understand. Is just that, maybe if you studied ecology, you can see that one action, or the weather systems and the complex systems, so on and so forth, right? But certainly in the destiny of the Jewish people, every single Jew, to understand that they have a place here, and they are moving us towards our destiny and our unique individual take on Torah and mitzvahs and the way we do it and the way we sing and the way we make kiddush and so on and so forth, is actually all part of that destiny leading the Jewish people back to where we're supposed to be going, to the true essence. So when Ephiatam was inspired, he said he's a miracle. And I agree, because his grandparents were killed back in Europe by their Romanian neighbors, and they were completely secular. If you would have told his grandparents they're going to have a grandson who's a rabbi, they would have thought you're insane. Insane. You told them because everyone's socialist, they're secular, etc. And if you would have told them they'll have a son who's going to be a minister, a commander of Jewish special force battalion in a Jewish army in the land of Israel, they would have thought I don't know what you're smoking. And then to tell you that your son also will go to a Hebrew-speaking university in Haifa, get a degree in mathematics and political science, become a minister, and have another grandson be a minister, and then you tell them tell them it's all the same grandson, which it was, then that's it. They're going to get money back from the fortune teller. Right? But that is part of the miracle of Jewish existence. The fact that we are here, we are Ud Mutzal Ma'esh, we are remnants of that. We have that destiny that Ephiatam, so that's what I learned from Ephiatam at least, to see yourself as part of that destiny of the Jewish people and to ally yourself with that. So those are some lessons. It's a very brief class, so we don't have time to go through all the Balachuvah history. But anyway, those are some lessons. Franz Rosenzweig, Jiri Langer, Eliezer ben Durdaya, and Ephiatam, a motley interesting group, but all united by that tshuva, returning to the true self, as Rav Kook says, im ein ani li mili, if I don't find myself, then no one can find it for me. And that is really what we're trying to do at this season. So, Shana Tova Masuka, Ksivach Sima Tova, thank you for listening.
Shkoch, you'll notice there's another $5.
Rats, I was hoping.